Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with employment attorney Jim Breedy from Sheehan Finney, and we're talking about the topic, how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training. And this is our part two, and we're welcoming Jim back now. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks so much, Dave.
You know, we're talking here about really anti-discrimination training, and last weekend we talked about what we called the first 12 steps, and there's an additional 8 that we're going to be talking about today. But tell me a little bit, if you could, why is this, again, so important for HR professionals, business leaders, to be thinking about to this scope, to this magnitude that we would dedicate two shows to?
Well, I think that because the issue has not gone away, sex harassment is still very much an active issue in the workplace, and it's evolved with the evolution of the workplace. And so it's not just male on female. It can be same-sex sex harassment. It can be gender-based discrimination in pay equity. It can also be issues related to discrimination against someone who's pregnant in the workplace and so on. Most importantly, though, is the evolution of the way in which people are harassed and complain, is that a lot of this is now electronic as opposed to face-to-face with remote employees, and also just the evolution of technologies in the workplace. And finally, it's just, again, human nature, and perhaps we can't get beyond the fact that we offend our coworkers for one reason or another. And and we also have a litigious culture. So the problem is workplaces have been complacent. They said, well, we've got a policy, or we've done training, or we've got something online you can look at during the onboarding and so on. And that EEOC and other practitioners like myself have found that is an ineffective or less than effective tool for really hammering home the importance of the anti-discrimination policy and how important it is to the organization.
What type of costs, again, would you say, you know, employees face in terms of either, you know, litigation or fines or different things? What type of expense are we really talking about? Let's put some monetary numbers behind this if we can.
So by way of an organization, you could be looking at in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend an individual claim or a class claim against several similarly situated individuals who found that the environment was hostile or that there was some sort of disparate treatment on the basis of gender. So that's one, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And more importantly, it's tying up important people and also taking their attention away from the business at hand, which is the business that you are in, as opposed to defending against claims. Now, that doesn't mean that all claims have merit, but even a claim that lacks legal or factual merit still can be expensive to defend and dispose of. So there's that cost. So whether we're talking about at the administrative level or when the case gets to court, it can be expensive both in time and legal fees, and the potential exposure not only for the organization, but also for potentially for individuals. And states like New Hampshire have found the possibility of individual liability for sex harassment. That means, or other forms of discrimination, and that means that you could have a situation where your CEO, your CFO, your COO, or even an HR person could be individually responsible. Now, traditionally, employers have provided what's called dual defense, which is the same lawyers representing the company might represent the individual. When there's individual liability, however, there's a possibility of having to get your own lawyer as the CEO, CFO, or other named officer or representative of the company. That means the individual can have great exposure on the back end, but also on the front end for purposes of just paying his or her own lawyer. And sometimes the company cannot actually pay for your lawyer because the potential for having separate and not necessarily consistent defenses.
Well, there's many, many reasons that this is so important. And so last week, we talked about the first 12 areas that we want to talk about in terms of creating problems and try to avoid them. Let's go quickly through them if we could, maybe have a quick point on each, and then we'll move into the main crux of the show, which is the additional tips that we're going to be. So the first one you said in terms of making sure the program should be live and facilitated by a qualified trainer who, as you put, effectively interacts with the audience. Why, again, is that so important?
Well, because if you just have a computer screen in front of you, you're less engaged. Or if it's something that is rote or just out of the can, again, it's not interactive, and so the person can be very passive and maybe even looking at his or her smartphone and otherwise drift away. If you have a facilitator who's not just the facilitator of the day, but somebody who really knows this and has dealt with these cases before or these matters before and can speak with it, with some intelligence towards the matter, it makes it more lively, more interactive, more interesting. And therefore, the person is likely to retain more.
The second one you said is make sure the C-suite is on board. God knows that's important. But, you know, why do you call that out?
Because, again, the problem is we can become complacent with regard to certain policies. And I think, well, isn't sex harassment, HR deals with those issues, and it's, you know, isn't that some 1970s or 1980s and so on? But raising the bar and saying, look, if we get sued or if there is a complaint, it's bad publicity for the company, it's bad for our stock if you're publicly traded, and it's just bad in the community. More importantly, it's expensive. And so we want you on board. And also to avoid situations where some member of the C-suite thinks that he or she is above the law and they're the perpetrator. So I'm getting them on board and understanding the corporate consequences, but also individual consequences of not following the policy and not following it to the letter of whatever the policy is important.
And of course, with this, we're talking about they should also take the training, including the board, correct?
Absolutely. And what that shows is that shows that we buy in and that we think this is important. And to the extent that they can even contribute to the training, it lends value.
So number three, you say make sure supervisors are on the same page.
Because your supervisor can be your eyes and ears, but also your Achilles heel. To the extent a supervisor sees or hears of a matter, it's as if the CEO heard at the same time. And if that supervisor says, well, I'll take care of the matter myself, or that's not sex harassment, I'll show you sex harassment, and so on, or, you know, that's just Bob being Bob, that can be a problem because if the matter stops there, the person says, well, that was ineffective, and it's to talk to your supervisor, talk to HR. My supervisor was ineffective, not helpful, and why would I bother going to HR? Plus, I fear retaliation by my coworkers and by my supervisor, so I'm not taking it forward. Instead, I'll jump off and file a lawsuit. And that's where you can have a problem with supervisors not being on board or thinking they can handle it themselves and, sadly, oftentimes mishandle it.
The number four is emphasize what is unacceptable versus what is illegal.
Yeah, that's because you may get into situations where, and typically when I do training, I get asked this question all the time. Well, if someone's having a bad day, you mean I can't hug them? Or if they're having a good day, you mean I can't hug them? And the answer is, oh, it depends. I mean, maybe. This is not an anti-hug rule. It is instead just defining what sex harassment is and giving specific examples in that regard or other forms of discrimination because, of course, these policies apply to other forms besides sex harassment. And then beyond that, saying, well, it may not be illegal, it may not fit textbook definition of discrimination in a hostile environment, we still find it to be unprofessional and unacceptable, and this is why.
The number five, and we're talking with Jim Reedy, by the way, with Sheehan Finney, employment attorney. We're talking about the topic of how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training. Number five is pretty clear. It says, review the employer's policy and provide specific examples of unacceptable behaviors as opposed to making general statements. Why is it so important, again, to really provide those specific examples?
Because if you say something along the lines of it's not acceptable to sexually harass a coworker or to create a hostile environment, that's such a global statement, nobody understands what exactly that means. So if it's left at that, you left people with questions as to what that means or their own interpretation of what that means. So instead, providing very specific examples and going through and showing how in your workplace, because what may work or may be important in a white-collar environment or the like may not be the same necessarily in a blue-collar environment or in a manufacturing and the like. Still, there are some common elements that are the same, but still getting away from legal definitions and getting into practical terms is what's the most effective way to make these policies come to life.
You know, this, I think, is such an important one. Number six, clearly state consequences for unacceptable conduct. I think that's so important.
Yeah, and, you know, most, if there's an alchemy or a common element for workplace claims, it's economics or how people feel about these things, economics and emotion mixed together. That's not only by the person who brings the claim, but also the person who's on the receiving end. But I think you have to let them know if we find that there is merit, or we find that there's, well, it may not be a textbook claim, if we find there's inappropriate conduct in the workplace, you could lose your job. And everyone, for the most part, lives up to their most recent paycheck, and nobody can really afford to lose their job. And along with that, having the effect upon their reputation, why aren't you there anymore? Well, I was accused of harassment in the workplace. Well, I deny it. Well, that's all. You never get to the second part of that statement. So it could affect your trajectory for your future employment as well. So outlining, this is serious. We mean it. And this is not just a rogue policy. These are ones with teeth. And if there is a complaint, these are the possible consequences.
Number seven is focus on risk factors that increase the likelihood of harassment, discrimination, or retaliation. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that in some regards is being aware of when you're sending your people into the field. But the way it's really happened in recent years is a lot of companies got rid of their holiday parties, because holiday parties were sort of the area where people were drinking too much and too relaxed, and bad conduct resulted. But apart from holiday parties, going through and talking about in certain environments where people may be afraid to speak up because they're afraid that their manager may, come down hard on them, or their coworker may come down. You have to make it welcoming and the like. So avoid situations where people are sort of in little work pods and don't feel that they can complain, or situations like off-premises, after-hours parties and so on, where people are a little bit more free and relaxed and not as careful as they perhaps should be.
Number eight, you talk about the training providing more examples, including subtle or passive forms of discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, we all understand the grotesque or the quid pro quo, which in 28 years I think I've had, of the hundreds of these cases I've handled, I probably had 3 quid pro quo cases, which is basically conditioning. You get the job, or you'll continue to work on the job, or you'll get a promotion if you'll agree to my advances. That's in the sex harassment area. We just don't see those very often. That's blatant and grotesque. What you see is the far more subtle, the brush by, the odd comment, the making someone feel uncomfortable, and so on. Where it's the definition of a hostile environment is severe or pervasive conduct that has the effect of unreasonably interfering with someone's ability to perform their job. Well, that's pretty broad, and it's broader still, because now that's been applied to race discrimination, national origin, age discrimination, and so on.
Number nine, we say make clear that harassment, hostile environment claims apply to all forms of discrimination.
Yeah, so that's just a carry on from what I just mentioned, which is that courts have said now it's not unique to sex harassment. It applies to other forms as well, specifically meaning hostile environment claims.
Number 10, give supervisors a clear path and suggestions on how to respond to complaints, concerns, rumors, and observed conduct.
Yeah, and there was a case a few years ago involving a university where several people complained about conduct, and the interim administrator said, well, unless those people come forward. Now, what had happened was faculty members came forward and said, I saw this going on, you may want to address the situation. Well, unless the victims come forward, there's nothing I can do about it. That's the wrong answer. Because, again, you're dealing with a situation of constructive knowledge. So if the administrator, the CEO, CFO, or even supervisor sees or has an inkling that something is going on, it's as if the person at the top of the organization actually had direct knowledge. It's called constructive knowledge. So it's basically letting supervisors know you have a duty to bring that information forward as quickly as possible.
Number 11, promise discretion, not absolute confidentiality.
There was a case involving a large box store years ago where a supervisor had gone to training, and days after that, a woman came forward and said, I would like to talk about this fellow who keeps asking me out. He was a coworker. And he said, well, what do you want me to do about it? And she said, well, I want it to stop. And he said, okay, I just went to training, so I understand what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to contact HR right away, and they will be in touch. They'll interview you. And she said, whoa, stop right there. I'm a single mom. I don't need any trouble. He said, I need to bring this forward. She said, you can't, because, you know, you guys won't keep it confidential, and I'm a single mom. I need this job. Well, what do you want me to do if I can't bring it forward? Just make it stop. So on his own, without bringing it forward, and saying, you must keep this confidential, and he said, okay. He transferred the guy to another department. The guy came back and was bothering her that much more. She quit. She got a lawyer. And she said, I told my supervisor 3 months ago, and they did nothing about it. Company knew nothing about it, but the company was held liable for that conversation 3 months early because he said he promised discretion and he promised confidentiality. We'll just keep it among ourselves. You cannot. You bring it forward, but you bring it forward on a need-to-know basis. You don't broadcast that someone's come forward a complaint because that can result in retaliation. Instead, you go to HR and other responsible individuals, and you make certain that there is a proper response.
As we wrap up last week's show in terms of part one, and again, we're talking with Jim Reedy. We're talking about how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for effective in-house anti-discrimination training. We have number 12, emphasize the need for a prompt and appropriate response to all complaints of discrimination or retaliation.
So the law talks about a prompt and appropriate response. While it doesn't prescribe what that's supposed to be, meaning 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, 2 months, whatever it is, you can be certain it means a prompt, quick, and appropriate, depending upon the circumstances, response. But that's the clock is ticking when a manager hears or should know that inappropriate conduct is going on, even in the absence of a complaint, that there must be a prompt and appropriate response. And certainly when there is a complaint, there's no question the clock is ticking. The standard over the years that's developed is basically 3 days that you must do something. If you say, well, I can't do anything because so-and-so is on vacation, you move ahead based upon the information you have. And assuming the person's not going on vacation to Mars, you can get in touch with them and find out whatever you need to at least move the ball along and let the person who complained know that we are taking this seriously and we're acting upon it. A prompt and appropriate response can be a very useful tool for the organization because if the organization, the employer, is truly prompt and has an appropriate response under the circumstances, it may shield them from liability for the underlying claim.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with employment attorney Jim Reedy and from Sheehan Finney, and we're going to be talking about the part two of how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training. You know, Jim, we talked about in the first section kind of a recap of last week and the first 12 topics that we went over, which really are about, you know, making sure people are ready and supervisors are ready. So let's get into some of the other tips here and other areas where we really can look at training and make it effective. And in this case, it's number 13. And the topic is focus on what retaliation is and why it should be avoided. Why? That seems kind of obvious. Why would we do something different?
Because retaliation is hard to pin down. It's like nailing Jell-O to the wall. I mean, it really is difficult because one person's sense of retaliation is not the same as someone else. And because it can be really subtle, you have to be very, very careful. The other thing to point out is the underlying claim of harassment may be dismissed as being legally deficient or not offered a good faith. However, if the person suffers retaliation for either bringing the complaint forward or for participating in the related investigation, a person can have an independent claim of retaliation. even if the underlying claims of harassment have been dismissed. What does that mean? Well, last year, nearly 100,000 discrimination claims were filed nationally. Of that, the number one most common charge of discrimination was retaliation. And retaliation in and of itself carries with it individual liability. So you may have a situation where, the underlying claim is against the organization, but you can have retaliation against the individual. And what does retaliation mean? It means many things. It means suffering what's called an adverse action as a result of bringing forward a claim or for participating in a related investigation. What's an adverse action? Failure to get promoted, failure to pay raise, bad evaluation, being frozen out of a project, being frozen out of, believe it or not, a social activity outside of work. And there was a case involving that a few years ago in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It can mean many things. If the person just has a vibe that ever since I brought that matter forward, or ever since I became vocal about the issue or participated in the investigation, things have just not been the same. She looks at me funny. He doesn't include me in emails, and so on. That's why retaliation is so important because, again, it's related to the underlying discrimination, but it also stands alone.
So, you know, retaliation is one of those, as you put it, it's a great description, you know, trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. So when companies look at, and that when employers, I should say in this case, have done the investigation and HR has done the investigation and they tell the person, hey, look, you know, this is a situation, and maybe it's a situation where the person was, you know, it was determined there was no harassment. And there's this, they're not happy. And they tell them not to, you know, retaliate. Should they sign something? Should they be more than told in this situation? Talk a little bit about the best approach to making sure that the person on the other side, who maybe was the accused, doesn't really truly understands how this can affect them.
Yeah, I think the most important thing, just like the underlying discrimination, is you have to know, while you don't agree with what you're accused of, while you don't agree with the version of events, he or she, in our determination, brought that complaint forward or participated in that investigation in good faith. Therefore, because our policy says we value this and we are an equal opportunity employer and we want you to come forward, we don't want you to create an environment whereby you're undercutting our policy. And I know it's difficult because you've been accused of something, and while you didn't agree with it, and you have your own version of events, you got to suck it up, and you got to do the right thing. Because if you don't, and there's a resulting retaliation claim, you could lose your job, and you could be personally liable.
Now, this also applies to if somebody, you know, brings it up, or you know, causes maybe somebody to feel uncomfortable because they were accused. And maybe it got out, and the information is in the workplace. Is that a fear or concern for the employer?
It is, and that's why we talk about being discreet but not offering complete confidentiality. And therefore, you know, monitoring afterwards is critical, meaning that you follow up with the supervisor who was accused or the coworker who was accused, and you encourage that person, look, we ask you not to speak of this with other people and certainly stay away from the rumor mill or the gossip by the water cooler or whatever the situation is, and certainly not bother that person going forward as much as possible. It's almost like having a workplace lobotomy. You have to basically remove that from your mind. Be aware of the conduct that he or she complained about, but let's get back to business as usual if at all possible. Very, very, very hard to do, but important for the organization to continue to monitor the victim who brought it forward, the people who participated in the investigation, the person who was accused, and others in the department to monitor. After a period of time, you can basically exhale because retaliation claims have to be causally connected and also temporally, meaning period of time, connected. How much time are we talking about? 3, 6, 12 months? You have to continue to monitor and avoid a recurrence or retaliation.
We're talking with Jim Breedy, employment attorney for Sheehan Finney, and we're talking about discrimination training and sexual harassment training. You know, one of the things that you give as a topic here is number 14, which is while it may not be harassment or discrimination, it may still be unacceptable. I think, you know, that's one of those things that come up, you know, repeatedly. It's that gray area, right? That's just not so clear, but you have to do something about it. So talk a little bit about that. And, you know, even if it's rude or behavior like that, you know, it's right on that line.
Yeah. And so you have a situation where, again, it doesn't rise to the level of textbook harassment or discrimination. However, it's still unacceptable and it still caused problems in the workplace. You may have just issues involving people aren't talking to one another or they're not being collegial going forward, and you have this balkanization in the workplace. It also could be a separate legal issue where the first person feels like he or she can't come forward and complain about terms and conditions of employment, which potentially could be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. So therefore, not discrimination, but it could be something else. Or your statute may deal with pay equity issues where, like in New Hampshire, you can't discipline someone for complaining about their pay. Well, if someone complained about their pay and they say, you know, so-and-so is a woman or a man, and he or she gets paid more than I do, and they say, well, actually, that's not the case, and you're getting paid based upon merit or whatever, but then you discipline the person for walking around complaining about their pay, you actually may have a situation where that's unacceptable, too. Unacceptable to be disciplined for that. And so it's outlining what's important to the culture, what could otherwise be illegal or improper is important, and providing as many examples as possible, because people have a preconceived notion of what sex harassment is and what inappropriate conduct is, and that may not necessarily align with what the company's expectations are. EEOC, when they did their recent study on the last 5 years of harassment trends, said one of their recommendations was that employers go back and do civility training. And all you have to do is watch the news or watch social media from the last couple of weeks, or certainly since the election. And I think we can all agree that we've lost a sense of civility in our culture. We'll go to the microcosm of the workplace, and that's true as well. People sit in cubicles or they communicate via electronics, and we don't have face-to-face, and therefore we're losing some degree of social skills. So going back to being courteous, in the Boy Scout creed, being courteous, kind, and obedient, not a bad idea.
No, you're absolutely right, and I really think about when you're talking about the social media, right? Which is right on the line as you're showing something about a joke or humor or whatever it is. And we're going to talk about that in number 15. I think that's a great segue, but you know, it's just one of those things that one person finds something to be, you know, a problem, and another person doesn't. And in the age of social media, in the age of, you know, electronic transmission, it just really makes that hypersensitive. Keep the program interactive, number 15, but know your audience. Humor is not always appropriate. Jim, I know you, and you know me. This is a tough area. We try to be funny.
Right. What did our mothers teach us, though, at one point? It's only funny till someone loses an eye.
Yeah, I remember that line, yeah.
and similarly in the workplace, that you have to be very careful because you don't necessarily always know your audience, and you don't know your audience's past. So when you joke about one thing or another, it can be difficult. While, Dave, your presentation style and mine is such that you make people feel at ease when you are relaxed, but also provide some degree of humor and so on. And certainly in your case, it's always well received. I've had a few blank stares a few times when I've tried. But the issue there is you have to be very careful because you can lose the point you're trying to make if someone suddenly gets offended by a comment that you made that was meant to be funny or meant to be harmless, and it wasn't received that way. You lose the impact of what you're trying to say. So I think that's an important one. I can give you a concrete example. Years ago, a lawyer was doing training with me and with a group, and he stood up and he said, because people had pronounced harassment different ways, and it was harassment or harassment and or whatever, and he said it depends upon if it's a woman, bring it forward, or a man. And talk about hearing a pin drop.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And he also made a similar comment right after that, thinking, well, this one people will like. And he said, what's the difference between a lawyer and a sperm? And without waiting for anyone to respond, he said, well, at least the the sperm has a 1 in a million chance of becoming a human being.
Oof. Yeah.
That met with similar silent response. The evaluations from that, though, come back and say, you know, highly inappropriate, got off point, in fact, to our topic today, created an environment that you were trying to actually avoid. I think that's important for whoever's performing the training, and sometimes it could be the supervisor who just wants to be collegial, but also one of the guys, and in doing so can create the problem and actually emphasize that this is not a healthy workplace.
No, and it's very true, and one of the things that certainly I know that when we've done the topic, you know, sometimes you ask the question, is anybody has ever dealt with this before, and you find out that someone in the audience may have dealt with it before. So, you know, that joke or that humor that you think might be effective for that, you know, it isn't funny to them. And so that, you know, it really is something you have to be very careful of when you're doing that. And just a side note, I did when my mother told me that joke, same line you heard, someone might lose an eye. I, of course, being the wise one, said they have another. And so that got me the same response as I'm sure you did. You don't say that to your mother, but I did try. I gave him my best effort. I didn't have dinner, but it was good. It was a good joke. It came back. It was what it was. We're talking with Jim Reedy. We're talking about, you know, training, harassment training. Number 16, before we go to break, let's talk about solicit comments, welcome questions, and test understanding. All good points.
Yeah, and I think what you want to do is, instead of being the talking head, and again, getting away from being the person on a computer screen, you want to ask people questions. You want to keep them engaged. You want to talk about the policy. You want to talk about their definition of things. Welcome questions without necessarily getting off the beam. And if you're going to cover a point later, so I'll get back to that later, but that's a good question. And then certainly test their understanding. I typically do that when I do training of this type. And I go through a series of questions, principally to get them engaged, but secondly to dispel certain myths that might be out there.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, it's always good, and I know some cases we recommend, and I'm sure you do, to put in their file, the employee's file, that they've taken the harassment training, that they've taken the, you know, whatever the training may be. And in some cases, we've provided quizzes so that there's actually proof that, hey, you did take it. You not only have some knowledge that you've taken back and attach that to the, you know, the participation survey. So I think in this particular case, it is always good and welcome to ask the questions and test for understanding. We're talking with Jim Reedy. He's an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. We're talking about how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be back in a minute.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. And we're talking with attorney Jim Reedy from Sheehan Finney. And we're talking about how not to create problems you are trying to avoid. Tips for effective in-house anti-discrimination training. Jim, we've gone through some great tips today. And, you know, really recap, this is part two of our show. And so we're at number 17, believe it or not. And it's called Monitor and Check Compliance with Issues After Training. Why is that so important? Hey, you did the training. Can't you just move on?
Yeah, you want to make certain that as you HR especially walks around the plant, or managers walk around the plant or workplace or whatever, that, you know, while you went to the training, checking in, what'd you think of the training? So in addition to the comments that day, it's also walking around, what you think, and then following up with not only the supervisors, but also checking with people that have filed complaints post-training and what they thought of the company's response to the matters.
You know, there are times business leaders say, you know what, I'm walking around, I'm listening, I'm doing my, you know, management by walking around, I'm doing all this sort of stuff, but do I really want to hear this? Do I really want to, you know, like, you know, if we do this training and now they're hypersensitive to it, we're going to have more problems. Why is that okay?
You know, I think that, you know, the issue there is, you know, you can't really avoid the problems. They're out there. And if you stick your head in the sand and say, well, if I don't ask, then nobody will tell me. And if they don't tell me or if I don't see it, then I don't have a problem that I'm going to have to get tied up in the next 6 months with lawyers and so on. Or are we creating a culture where everybody's offended at everything and that's more likely to be the situation? Because, you know, a lot of claims are not valid claims of discrimination on the basis of gender, age, national origin, and so on. But the important thing there, again, is the person could still be offended, it could still be disruptive in your workplace, and you could still have a potential retaliation claim if you mishandle it. So you're better off, and again, we're living in an age where it's hard to find good and talented people, and more, whether we're talking about ex-gens who are millennials, aren't as tied to the workplace as their predecessors were. So you want to create a culture that that values retention of good employees. So by monitoring, following up, checking, and so on, you're creating a welcoming environment that likely could do two things. One is to avoid the underlying bad conduct to begin with, and secondly, to deal with it appropriately. And people do value that because, in the end, someone will enjoy doing their work if they're left alone or they feel supported. If they are isolated or feel that it is a hostile environment, they're more likely to move on and file a complaint.
We're talking about tips on how to improve anti-harassment in the workplace. Number 18, be fair and consistent with discipline and correction. So, you know, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about this, but one of the things that always comes up is what should you or should you not say to the person that has been potentially harassed? Because how much can you tell them about the person that, hey, may have done the issue and what's the discipline of that person? And so forth and so on. So that's always the question that has come up. And so as you talk about being fair and consistent, if you could add that into your answer.
So fair and consistent would be that obviously it has to be the appropriate response to the circumstances. So if it was a one-off and the person was offended and, you know, you could say, "Let's, you know, gosh, you got to be more careful about what you say," or perhaps you didn't know this about him or her and this is how he or she took it. That's one thing, and the person usually is contrite and says, gosh, I didn't realize, I'll be more careful going forward, and so on. But what if it's the person that's like the serial hugger or the serial offender, and they don't seem to get it, they're tone deaf to all sorts of social cues, and you have to be more serious, suspension, demotion, or termination, and then you get that, you follow up with the person who brought forward the complaint, said, I want to let you know we've dealt with the situation, and oftentimes you get that question saying, oh yeah, what did you do? Well, I think it's important to share, you know, he or she's been spoken to, they're going to apologize to you, they're going to stay away from you in certain settings and so on, or they're going to amend their behaviors and the like and be more sensitive to the situation, but make sure you come forward and tell me if anything else happens. But or if it's, you know, he's not here this week because he's been suspended or he's been demoted and moved to another department. I think being clear like that helps to reinforce the policy. Do you have to get involved in all the things you said to the person? No, you let them know what needs to be done, which is we took it seriously, we responded, this is what happened, and this is what we're going to do going forward. That should be sufficient. Sometimes they ask for more, sometimes they want more in writing. It's just sort of balance the equities. It depends upon what goes on. But I think letting them know that you took it seriously and there was an appropriate response should be enough.
To your point you just mentioned, should the employer have in writing what they have found about their investigation to the employee who, in fact, filed the complaint?
Not necessarily. You can do it in global terms, which is thank you for bringing this matter forward. Obviously, we take these matters seriously, as we shared with you. You raised these issues. We've responded in this way. Does it have to be more detailed than that? Not necessarily, because all that really is necessary is that you speak to the person and you deal with them directly. Is there a document, however, that lives on? Yes, absolutely, because 3 months, 6 months, a year, 18 months later, if that same person offends or does something similar to someone else, you want to go back and point to, wait a minute, we spoke to you, and this is what happened, and we told you what the consequences would be going forward if you did something like this again. Now we're sort of at the next level. Similarly for the victim, you want to have some sort of records. So if he or she files a claim later, you want to show, wait a minute, we took it seriously, there was a prompt and appropriate response, and this is what we did.
So we're talking with Jim Reedy, employment attorney for Sheehan Finney. We're talking about how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training. Jim, we got two left here, two big ones left. Number 19, schedule follow-up sessions and update the material as needed. Geez, you mean it doesn't stay the same? Nothing ever changes?
Maybe my hairline and the color of my hair, but apart from that, that certainly changes. The core concepts with regard to civility, harassment, and the like, it basically remain the same, which is, you know, people should be guaranteed effectively a workplace where they're free from that hostile work environment, illegal hostile environment and the like, and that they should know that their complaints are welcomed and will be dealt with in an appropriate fashion. The nature of sex harassment and other forms of discrimination has evolved over time as our population has become more diverse, but also as our technology has developed. So as a result, and you always want to freshen up your materials anyway, if you have antiquated terms, the terms that, you know, we use with our kids and our kids roll their eyes, it's like, well, you know, Dad, this isn't the 50s anymore, or Dad, this isn't even the 90s anymore. This is 2017. So being current, staying up to date, and using terms that are something that the audience will certainly understand and concepts they will understand makes sense. You also want to keep the materials up to date with developments in the law. A few years ago, there was a couple that worked for an airline, and one was engaged to the other, so they were fiancé. She was subjected to sexual harassment by her supervisor. He did not work for the same supervisor, but he was very vocal about the treatment that his fiancé had suffered and how he felt the company was responding. His supervisor didn't like the fact that he was so vocal and disruptive in the workplace and disciplined him. He brought forward a complaint. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said he may have an underlying claim of retaliation, even though he wasn't the victim of the underlying harassment. So he may have an independent claim, rather, of retaliation, even though he wasn't subjected to the underlying harassment. He was a bystander, and so on. And the law said, well, who do we protect? And that was a question that came to the Supreme Court. And they said, we're not going to define that. We'll leave that for Congress to define. However, in the meantime, we'll say it has to be more than a mere casual relationship. You have to have so in that case, it was people that were engaged, a couple that was engaged. How about people that are married? Probably. What about a father and son? Well, the First Circuit said, in a case in the last couple of years, yes, that could be, because that's more than a mere casual relationship. What about lifelong friends? Courts to date have said, no, that's not enough for purposes of someone being protected as a bystander for retaliation. But that's an example of how the law continues to evolve.
We're talking with Jim Reedy. He's the employment attorney at Sheehan Finney. He is one of he is the most important. He is the best. How's that? Any of those work for you, Jim?
I'll take them all.
And we're talking to him about how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, tips for an effective in-house anti-discrimination training. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back with the last tip.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we've been talking with Jim Reedy, appointment attorney for Sheehan Finney, and we've talked about literally the 20 tips on how not to create problems you are trying to avoid, effective in-house anti-discrimination training. Jim, we've had a great discussion today. I know this is part two, but it was great to recap over the first segment, and now we're at number 20, and it seems so obvious, but yet sometimes forgotten. It's maintain training attendance logs and materials. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, so the law says in order for organizations to be shielded by or from vicarious liability, meaning liability that, you know, when they're co-workers are harassing one another and someone complains, and for the employer not to be liable, they must have a prompt and appropriate response. So part of that is the individual response to that particular matter, but also a commitment to training. An example I can give is that, you know, someone files a complaint of harassment, hostile work environment, and so this has been going on for years. And the company's response is, well, this is the first we've heard of it, and we've done training every year, and you attended the training, and you knew how to forward it, bring forward a complaint. Why is it that you're bringing that complaint forward now, and why didn't you bring it to our attention earlier when we could have addressed it? That's a good defense. Plus, apart from that strategic decision for having training, it just makes good sense to reinforce the company's policies. And also, when people are changing positions, you have a new HR person, a new supervisor, a new CEO, and so on, or that you've merged and you have perhaps a different or broader corporate culture, you want to, or you have different systems in place for purposes of complaint, you want to bring forward and let folks know what's available. So not only did they attend the training, but also what did the training cover? Because that could actually be a defense in the case, too, or just to refresh people's recollections. Those training materials, as we said earlier, should be updated and change as the company and the culture and the law changes. But keeping all that stuff could be important down the road should someone file a complaint.
Is there any time limit in terms of how long into somebody's employment should they be provided this training? I know typically the harassment policy is provided to them on day one, but is there any rules in the law, or is there anything, and it may be state-related, as I believe it is, is there something that says, hey, you need to complete it by 90 days, 60 days, 30 days, once a year? I mean, what is your best answer to that?
Well, in Massachusetts and in other states, you're required, or it's strongly suggested, you have annual training. And the question is, when should you do the training? When someone becomes an employee, obviously you're not going to train them during the interview, but onboarding process for sure, as a part of getting familiar with who we are and what we do here in our organization. But I wouldn't go too far down the road for someone who's a new employee. You'd want them to be familiar with, if they say complain to so-and-so in HR or complain to the corporate offices here or there, they should know where that is. So early in the relationship, but not too far down the road, where that person may have experienced harassment or a hostile environment of some sort and didn't know where to bring forward the complaint. So early, very early on the relationship, that's not a bad idea during onboarding. And then thereafter, at least annually.
You know, we've been talking a lot about, of course, anti-discrimination training. We've talked a little about why it's so important. Do you have a case that you could share with the audience that would kind of provide an overview, kind of a wrap-up here, as to something that, you know, people could really sink their teeth into and say, hey, this is a good reason why we should really make sure we get this right and do the 20 tips that you talked about today?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many examples over time, because I've handled probably hundreds of these cases in my career. And I think that the most important would be drawing on, I'll do sort of a collection. It's almost greatest hits all in one case. Well, you've got a manufacturing facility that's international, and it's got operations on three shifts. And as we all know, nothing good happens on third shift. It's sort of a netherworld. And you've got males and females on the third shift, and it's, you know, things are getting too comfortable, and comments are being made. There's touching, there's grabbing, there's inappropriate suggestions and the like. And the problem is that this is also an international company, so you have, you've got a report to HR not only here but also abroad. And abroad, the culture is a little different. They don't seem to understand the context for training, or the legal issues are not quite the same. So it's a bit of a disconnect there. But so you've got this important product that you're trying to turn out. Third shift is critical. You're working long hours. People are tired, but are also, again, it's third shift, and nothing good ever happens on third shift. Things are happening in the workplace where you've got this supervisor that has got a fiefdom unto himself and says, I control third shift and so on. So people are afraid of him, don't bring forward complaints. Person finally gets up the confidence and or courage to bring forward a complaint. But the problem is third shift ends at 7 o'clock and HR doesn't open till 8 and doesn't know and slips a note under the door, but there's a disconnect for not only days but weeks in bringing forward a complaint. When they investigate the matter, it turns out that the person has been spoken to, meaning the victim has been spoken to a number of times about the quality of his or her work, but also because of attendance, and it appears that he or she was on the verge of being terminated anyway. Person says, I was on the verge of being terminated because I spoke up against my bad acting supervisor. The person leaves the company and files a lawsuit. The company's on the verge of a large international contract that might even involve federal funding, and there's a lot at stake. There's a lot of back and forth that goes on for years. It costs the company hundreds of thousands of dollars. In the end, there's a settlement because the case doesn't go to trial, because very few of these cases do go to trial. And what are you left with? If we had a complaint procedure that was more effective, we had a way of a person not having to wait till HR opened, but they could email that HR was attentive, the supervisor was watched, and there had been instances during the case where it came out that the supervisor had done this with regard to others. They came out of the woodwork. The company knew or should have known about the bad conduct and didn't respond. There hadn't been training in years and had all these things basically lined up for costing the company north of $500,000 to resolve that matter. Had there been training, had you had a more attentive supervisory staff, had there been consequences for bad conduct before, had there been an appropriate complaint procedure where there was a prompt and appropriate response, likely all these matters and certainly the cost could have been avoided.
There is no question that that is a great example of why this is so important. Again, Jim Reedy, appointment attorney, Sheehan Finney. Go to HRPowerHour.com. You can certainly find his information. Contact him directly. Jim, I want to thank you so much for doing both shows, part one and part two, on this important topic.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Tani Alvarez at Feral Dana. For all our listeners who see snow during the winter months, they likely have been dealing with employees who are calling out because they do not feel safe driving on the roads. Whether the concerns are legitimate or not is not the point of this Power Minute, but instead to remind you of the importance of having a weather policy. Can individuals telecommute when the roads are bad? If so, who is included? Everyone? Or only certain positions? Are employees required to take vacation or personal time for such a call-in? Or can the time be taken unpaid? These questions and more should be considered when crafting a weather policy. To learn more, contact a member of Veral Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group for more advice and insight.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com.